This is the September 2024 edition of Ask, Science and Exploration for Curious Kids. The front cover of the magazine is titled Surprising Snacks and shows a young child looking at a creature embedded in some sort of material. Page 2, Nosy News by Tracy von der Brink. Throw the mad away. Everybody feels angry sometimes, and getting over being mad can be hard. Scientists in Japan may have found something that will help. Write down what made you mad and then throw it away. The scientists tested 50 college students. The students were told mean things about their work and then asked to write down what had happened and how the mean things made them feel. One group kept what they wrote. Another group threw their papers away or ran them through a shredder. The group that kept their papers said they still felt just as angry, but the group who threw away or shredded theirs said it made them feel better. The scientist who led the study says he hopes people can use the technique as a quick way to bounce back when they're upset. Marvin says to Plush Potum, maybe you should write down how you feel. Sea floor cables get smarter. Tsunamis are giant waves caused by earthquakes, and they're often devastating, especially when they hit an area where a lot of people live. Because underwater earthquakes are hard to detect, tsunamis can happen with little or no warning. Now, smart cables could help change that. Hundreds of cables already crisscross the ocean floor, carrying our internet and cell phone data. Scientists say when new cables are put on the seafloor, sensors could be added to them. The sensors would monitor seafloor motion, water temperature, and pressure so that warnings could be sent as soon as an earthquake big enough to cause a tsunami happens. Scientists could also study climate change by looking at changes in seawater temperature. Portugal and the South Pacific Islands of New Caledonia and Vanuatu have signed deals to have the new smart cables installed. Scientists hope more countries will follow soon. Puck says to Sisyphus, if we feel an underwater earthquake, I'll call it in. Be kind to the queen. Queen bumblebees spend the winter hibernating in underground burrows, then come out in spring to form a new colony. Scientists wondered what the queen bumblebees did right after waking up. So they placed the tiny antenna on some bumblebees' backs and track them with radar to find out. The scientists were surprised to learn that the queens didn't fly away immediately. Instead, the bumblebees spent 10 to 20 minutes resting on the ground in between taking short 10 to 20 second flights. The team says their discovery suggests people can help give bumblebees a better start by leaving grass long and not cleaning up leaves until late spring, so that the queens have a safe place to rest. There's a photograph of a resting bumblebee that reads, I'm unbelievably tired. I'm going to skip Nestor's doc and read on page 6, The Secret Life of Cookies by Layla Nargi, art by Marnie Galloway. Rasputin says to Zia, how to make perfect cookies. This is for us. Like any good science experiment, cookies start with collecting all the ingredients and measuring them carefully. Let's meet the cast of your future cookies. Baking cookies looks as easy as eating them, but just how does a gooey mess turn into something so delicious? First is flour, the ground-up seeds of the wheat plant. It gives your cookies body, kind of like the stuffing in your mattress. Without it, there'd be nothing to bite into. Baking soda, sodium bicarbonate, or baking powder, which is baking soda plus a little acid, will help your cookies rise. Butter is fat from milk. It keeps your cookies moist and makes other flavors tastier. Eggs are also very important for your cookies. As they cook, the mixed-in eggs hold your cookies together in a firm shape. And don't forget the most important part, chocolate chips. What would cookies be without sugar? Weird crackers. Sugar is made from the dry juice of the cane plant. Brown sugar has some natural molasses in it. White sugar has the molasses taken out. Many recipes use a mix of brown sugar and white sugar. Finally, salt and vanilla add flavor. The secret is chemistry. Mix up just the right ingredients in just the right way, then add heat. Marvin says to Bot, "Mixing chemicals? Experimenting? Exploding gases? This is for us." Now, mix them together. It's important to add the ingredients in the right order. If you add the eggs to the flour first, the dough gets gluey and slippery and makes it hard to blend in the butter. First, in one bowl, beat together the butter and both sugars. Then, add the eggs and vanilla. Add gradually while stirring. Measure carefully. Too much flour and your cookies will be dry. Too much butter and they'll be flat and oily. In a second bowl, mix the flour, salt, and baking soda. Now mix the wet and dry ingredients together, combining gradually. Finally, add the chocolate chips. Some people also add chopped nuts, raisins, or coconut. Yum! Drop spoonfuls onto a cookie sheet. Ask a grown-up to help you bake them in an oven preheated to 375 degrees Fahrenheit, 190 degrees Celsius, for 9 to 10 minutes, and soon, cookies! So what exactly goes on inside that oven? Mostly heat. Heat is a great change maker. Heat shakes up all the separate ingredients in dough and makes them combine in new ways. Let's watch through the oven door. First, as the dough heats up, it spreads out. That's the butter melting. Baking soda makes the cookies rise. When baking soda meets acids from the sugars, it releases carbon dioxide gas, the same thing that gives soda its fizz. The bubbles push the dough up. Baking powder does the same thing. Tiny water droplets in the dough, from the eggs and butter, boil into steam. This puffs the dough up even more. The cookies start to rise. Before the cookies spread out too far, the eggs start to cook. Eggs cook in cookie dough the same way they do in a frying pan. Egg whites are full of long, tangly proteins. In a raw egg, each protein is curled up in a little ball, but heat makes them uncurl. Then they get tangled up with other proteins, forming a dense net. This net makes the dough firm up. It's cooked. As the cookies get hotter, some of the water inside evaporates, drying them out a bit. When the dough heats up to 310 degrees Fahrenheit, the tastiest changes start to happen. Protein and sugars snap together to make many new flavors and delicious smells. This flavor-building party is called the Maillard reaction. It's what gives cooked food, from toast to turkey, that delicious roasted taste and shiny color. Finally, it's the sugar's turn. At 356 degrees Fahrenheit, the sugar on the surface of the cookies starts to melt and turn brown and crispy. This is called caramelization. If you want paler, softer cookies, bake your cookies at 350 degrees Fahrenheit. Customize your cookie. Changing the recipe will change the cookies you get. Experiment. Every cook has his or her own favorite recipe for the perfect cookies. Ratsputin says, "I like to add some blue cheese." These experimental chefs want to make you a cookie unlike any you've ever eaten before. Mad food scientists. Some modern chefs are using science to play with food in all sorts of new ways. They wonder, what would happen if I use sugar that fizzes when it gets wet? Or, what if I cook the dough in a vat of hot water? Or, if I froze it instead of baking it? Or turn the ingredients into foam? They call themselves molecular chefs, though all chefs play with molecules. Chef Claire Crenshaw invented a no-bake chocolate chip cookie for the Moto restaurant in Chicago. At dessert time, diners were given a tray with ingredients, little bowls filled with butter, sugar, and chocolate chips. Another bowl contained flour made of ground-up biscuits and sticky tapioca powder. The last bowl held frozen custard that looked like a raw egg. At the dinner table, guests mixed up all the ingredients from the bowls, but they didn't cook the mixture. They gobbled it up with a spoon and washed it down with cold milk. How do you think it would compare to your favorite chocolate chip cookies? Those cookies always changing. Making molecules. The secret of cooking and chemistry is making molecules change. Molecules are very small bits of matter, but not the smallest bits. They are made of two or more atoms stuck together, a little like Legos. And like Legos, just a few basic kinds of atoms can be put together in millions of different ways to make all sorts of molecules. The number of atoms in a molecule and how they're put together make stuff what it is, sugar or meat or plastic. Molecules come in all shapes and sizes. A water molecule has just 3 atoms in it. Table sugar has 45 atoms, 12 carbon, 22 hydrogen, and 11 oxygen. Proteins are huge molecules with many thousands of atoms. Cooking and chemistry works by using heat or other energy to break apart molecules and put them together differently to make something new. Though getting them to change the way you want, that's the trick. Avery says, humans eat the strangest things. The cookie says, I say, if you have to eat it with a spoon, it's not a cookie. And Zia says, if I like it, it's a cookie. Page 12. A Rainbow of Food by Karen Stevenson. Dinner time. It looks delicious. Tasty red tomatoes, green beans, yellow corn. But why does food come in so many colors? Food gets its colors from special color-making chemicals called pigments. Some plants make pigments on purpose to be colorful. Other pigments protect plants from damage or do other jobs. They help people too. Color tells us a lot about our food. Before we touch, smell, or taste it, we judge it by what we see. Red strawberries, yum. But green strawberries are not ripe yet. Green meat is probably spoiled, and green bread has likely had a visit from the mold fairy. Red. Red means stop, but for plants, it can mean go. Plants can't walk, but they want their seeds to travel. Seeds wrapped in ripe fruit attract animals with their tasty smells and bright colors. Many fruits change color when they are ready to eat. A green cherry hides in the leaves. Red cherries signal, ripe fruit here, come and eat. Hungry birds and animals carry the seeds to a new place to grow. Because so many tasty fruits are red, our eyes notice red more than other colors. Red means delicious. Orange. Orange takes its name from the orangest of all fruit, the orange. But surprisingly, some kinds of oranges are actually green, even when they're ripe. Their skin turns orange only in cold temperatures. In warm climates, they stay green. But we expect oranges to be orange, so fruit sellers give them a cold shock to turn them orange or dip them in orange dye. Many orange vegetables get their color from a pigment called carotene. Your body uses carotene to make vitamin A, so orange is a good color to look for in vegetables. It says, lots of vitamin A for you. Yellow. Different animals see color differently. Monkeys see orange and yellow well. Many tropical fruits are orange and yellow. This invites monkeys to eat them and spread their seeds. Birds have excellent color vision. They can spot berries that are blue or purple or red. But squirrels and mice don't see colors well. They often eat dull brown foods. Avery says, I don't think brown is dull. And Elvis says, are you new to the neighborhood? Blue. Have you ever seen a blue raspberry? There aren't many blue foods in nature. In fact, blue can turn people off their food. That's why you don't see blue French fries in restaurants, even though some kinds of potatoes are naturally purple. But if you walk down the candy aisle, you'll find lots of bright blue, raspberry-flavored candies. How did they get this peculiar color? It started with the ice pop industry. These frozen fruit-flavored treats are naturally clear. The people who make them add colors, so we know for choosing orange or grape or cherry flavor. But the first ice pop makers had a problem. They had too many red flavors: strawberry, cherry, watermelon, raspberry. They also had blue coloring, but no flavor to go with it. They heard about a fruit called a blue raspberry. The berries are really more purple than blue, but the name was enough. They put the blue coloring into the raspberry-flavored pops, and that's how raspberry turned blue. Plush Potum says, maybe they turned blue with cold. Green. Green is the color of plants making food for themselves and also for us. The bright green comes from chlorophyll, a special cell part that plants use to make sugar from sunlight, water, and air. When trees stop making chlorophyll in the fall, the green fades and other colors show through. We can see the oranges and yellows that were always there underneath. The same thing can happen in your kitchen. If green veggies spend too long in a dark fridge, they lose their chlorophyll and turn yellow, just like a fall leaf. Purple. Most carrots in stores are orange now, but long ago the carrots people grew were yellow or purple. There are even paintings of purple carrots in ancient Egyptian tombs. All carrots are descended from a wild plant with a bitter white root. Some wild carrots tasted a bit sweeter or were an interesting color. People saved seeds from these better-tasting, better-looking carrots and planted them. Over time, carrots got sweeter and more colorful. Orange carrots taste the sweetest and keep their color during cooking, so eventually they won out over the purple carrots. Plant pigments aren't just pretty. Color is a sign of something special inside. The carotene that makes carrots orange is also good for your eyes. The blue in blueberries can help build cells. Red tomatoes are good for your heart. So shake up that dull brown dinner and enjoy the whole rainbow of food. Zia says to Plush Potum, now I'm working on a pink carrot. Green Eggs, page 16. Art by Thor Wickstrom. Would you eat them on the moon with a mischievous raccoon? Marvin's carrying a sign that says, Marvin, I am. If you dare, you can give your family a delightful breakfast surprise with a little help from a cabbage. Avery says, would you eat them in a hole? Would you eat them with a mole? What you'll need: some red cabbage, grated, hot water or microwave, eggs, two bowls, pan for frying eggs, grown-up accomplice, brave family. What to do? First, make a little red cabbage juice. Ask a grown-up to help with the grating and boiling, and maybe the egg frying. 1. Grate some red cabbage or get some from a salad bar, about a cupful. 2. Put the grated cabbage in a bowl, pour boiling water over it or heat in the microwave. 3. Let it cool, then strain out the cabbage pieces, save the red water in a jar. Time for the magic. 4. Ask a grown-up cook to help you separate the egg yolk from the white. Put the white in a bowl and save the yolk in a cup. You'll need it in a minute. 5. Add a couple of spoonfuls of the cabbage juice to the egg white. Mix with a fork. Look, it turns green. The more you add, the darker green it will get. 6. Pour the cabbage and egg white mix into a frying pan and drop the yolk back on top. Fry it up. Serve to your family for a lovely surprise. What's going on? Red cabbage juice has an interesting trick. Its natural purple color will turn pink when it meets an acid like vinegar, or blue when it meets acids opposite a base, like baking soda. Egg whites are just a little bit base, so the cabbage juice turns them green, but it only works when the eggs are raw and liquid, so the egg can mix with the juice. More fun. Use your leftover cabbage juice to test some other things around your kitchen. Soap, baking powder, mustard. Can you find some other acids and bases? There's a photograph of cassowary green. Emu and cassowary eggs are naturally green, but only on the outside. The yolks of boiled eggs sometimes turn green if the egg is cooked too long. The green yolk is perfectly safe to eat. Cabbage juice will also make lovely green scrambled eggs, or just add a couple of drops of blue food coloring. When chickens eat acorns, sometimes they lay eggs with green yolks. Rasputin says, to get green eggs, I just let them sit around for a while. Page 18. Cheese, Please, by Meg Moss. Photos by Michael Burke, art by Thor Wickstrom. Some of the best cheese in the world starts in barns like this one. Rasputin asks, is it done yet? Are you tired of the same boring old cheese in flat orange squares or powdered in a can? If so, you're in luck. The world is full of wonderful, tasty cheeses. That's what Liddy and Earl discovered one day last summer when they came to our farm to help us make cheese straight from the goat. So how do you turn plain old milk into tasty, chunky cheese? It takes patience, heat, and some friendly bacteria. The goat is thinking, let's make some cheese. There's a photograph. The caption reads, Liddy and Earl begin their day of cheese making by going straight to the source. Meet Carolina, our milk goat. Earl is thinking, I have an important job, giving Carolina a scratch. Move over, Miss Muffet. All cheese starts with milk. You can make cheese from any kind of milk, cow's milk, goat's milk, sheep's milk, even water buffalo's milk. Cheese is the solid fats and proteins from the milk with the liquid part drained away. The next ingredient in cheese is bacteria. While you don't want harmful bacteria in your milk, you'll need good bacteria to kick off the cheese-making process. Today, most milk is heated or pasteurized to kill harmful bacteria, but some cheesemakers prefer using raw milk straight from the animal. It makes cheese with a full, rich taste. It can even add hints of grassy or grainy flavors, depending on what the animal eats. The squeaky cheese. We decided to make halloumi, a traditional cheese from the Mediterranean and Middle East. Halloumi, from an Arabic word meaning mild, is a very old type of cheese. It may have fed the pharaohs of ancient Egypt. It has a mild flavor and squeaks against your teeth when you chew it, and it is delicious. Our goat, Carolina, was happy to give us several pounds of milk to start our adventure. Liddy watches the temperature carefully to keep from overheating the milk. For our halloumi, 86 degrees Fahrenheit, 30 degrees centigrade, is the magic number. Raw milk has a load of good bacteria already, but if you use pasteurized milk, you'll need to add starter, packaged bacteria especially for cheese making. Gently heating the milk helps these good guys grow. As they grow, they change the sugars in milk into acids. These acids cause the milk to separate into solid curds and liquid whey, but you don't want the bacteria to make too much acid or your cheese will get sour. To help the curds and whey separate faster and stay sweet, cheesemakers also add rennet, an enzyme from the stomachs of calves that helps them digest their mother's milk. Once Earl and Letty add rennet to our milk, they stir gently to mix it in. Like magic, the curds and whey begin to separate after about 12 minutes. Curds the word. Half an hour later, our pot is filled with a custard-like mass of curd. We'll need to cut this into small chunks to get out all the whey. To see if the curd is ready for cutting, Liddy tests it with her finger. If it breaks cleanly away from her finger, it's time. Once the curd is cut, we heat it gently, stirring all the time. The jiggly chunks of curd begin to firm up into squishy little globs. They are drier and smaller now, and when we pinch them gently between our fingers, they feel almost rubbery. Finally, the curd is ready for the next step. Squeeze the cheese. Time for the cheese press. This does exactly what its name says. It squishes the curds into a firm chunk of cheese and squeezes out every last bit of whey. Liddy and Earl pack our curds into a round mold and set the presses to squeeze them for 30 minutes. Halloumi cheese, which we are making today, is great for grilling because it doesn't get runny when it's cooked, like other cheese. To make it unmeltable, we cut the pressed cheese into wedges and boil them in the whey until they float. Finally, the cheese goes into a bath of salty water called brine. It can stay there for up to 60 days, or we can eat it for dinner. We did! The brine adds flavor and preserves the cheese. There are more than 1,800 kinds of cheese in the world. Each one is different, but everyone starts with patience, heat, bacteria, milk, and perhaps a pinch of magic. The goat is thinking, I am so proud. Ratsputin says 1,800 varieties, and I'm going to try them all. There's some photographs of the children making the cheese. In the first, Earl adds the rennet as Liddy gently stirs it in. Earl cuts the curd oh so carefully. Liddy decides the curd is ready for pressing by feeling it between her fingers. The yellowish liquid in the pot is whey. Now to pack the curds into the cheese mold and the last photo and set the cheese press to 30 pounds, 14 kilogram of pressure. Ta-da! It's cheese. All cheese starts out pretty much the same way. In this Parmesan cheese factory in Parma, Italy, shown in the photograph, the cheese maker feels the curds to see if they are ready. Then workers lift the curds out of the whey in a cloth. Parmesan cheese is aged for many months before it is ready to eat. Back on page 20, who invented cheese? It might have been an accident. The story may go something like this. About 10,000 years ago, when people were first raising animals to milk, a traveler filled his leather canteen with milk before a long journey. Back then, canteens were often made from animal stomachs. After a hot, bouncy ride, he reached for his milk, but it had turned into a sweet, soft mush. What happened? He had discovered the magic of rennet, a special stomach juice that helps calves and other young animals digest milk. Rennet separates milk into solid curds and liquid whey, and that's the start of cheese. Ratsputin says, I'd like to shake his hand. The man on the camel is thinking, might need new shocks? Page 22, Bug Bites, by Rachel Young. Have you heard the joke about the customer who finds a fly in his soup? Waiter, he shouts, there's a fly in my soup. The waiter hurries over, shushing him, please, keep your voice down, sir, or everyone will want one. Who on earth would want to eat a bug? You might be surprised. Avery says, I like the earthworm spaghetti. To those of us who've never crunched a cricket or slurped a worm, the idea of eating bugs might sound pretty gross. We wouldn't eat those creepy crawlies even if someone dared us. Yet lots of bugs are nutritious, tasty, and perfectly safe to eat. Are we missing out on a good thing? In fact, in Australia, South America, Africa, and Asia, eating bugs is no joke. Bugs aren't just pets. They're lunch or dinner or a nice after-school snack. Eat up, we're outnumbered. Eating bugs is an old habit. Over 10,000 years ago, before our ancestors learned to farm, They found food by hunting and gathering. Bugs were considered part of the daily diet. It made sense for ancient people to eat a source of nutrition that was right under their noses or buzzing by their ears. As you've probably noticed, bugs are everywhere. Scientists estimate that there are 1.4 billion of the little critters for every person on the planet. No wonder more than half the people on Earth eat bugs daily, or the million or so types of bugs that scientists have named so far. More than 2,000 are somebody's favorite snack. The most popular bugs to eat are crickets and termites, which are said to taste a bit like pineapple, but lots of other bugs are edible too. Restaurants in Mexico sell ant tacos. Cans of baby bees line supermarket shelves in Japan. In Thailand, outdoor markets offer silkworm larvae. And in Mozambique, in eastern Africa, people call grasshoppers flying shrimp. Sisyphus says to Puck, "Eat more bugs and less seafood." There's a photograph, and the caption reads, "Why should birds have all the fun? Fresh, fried bugs can make a tasty snack. Bugs do a body good. Dinner is served. On one plate, a big juicy hamburger, and on the other, a heaping pile of cooked grasshoppers. Ground beef or bugs? Which one do you think is better for your body? Both have lots of protein, which is what your body uses to build muscle. But in other ways, grasshoppers clearly come out ahead. A pound of grasshoppers has less fat than a pound of beef, and the insects are higher in calcium and iron. Other bugs are good for you, too," says biologist David George Gordon, author of The Eat a Bug Cookbook. "I tell kids if your bones are still growing, eat more crickets and termites. Not only are grasshoppers better for you than beef, they're also better for the planet. It takes a lot of grass and water and space to raise a cow. Imagine how many grasshoppers you could raise on the same amount of land. Still, wouldn't pick the grasshoppers?" Gordon says they also taste delicious, a lot like green peppers. There's a photograph, and the caption reads, "Toasted scorpions on a stick, anyone?" Elvis says, "Roasted with a little salt and butter, they are superb," standing next to the plate of grasshoppers. At the top of page 25, "Why do bugs have a bad rap?" So bugs are everywhere. Eating them is good for you and for the planet. Lots of people all over the world think bugs taste great. Why don't we? No one is sure of the answer, but some people think that bugs' bad reputation in some cultures may have begun with the first farmers. When our ancestors began to raise most of their own food, insects that might feast on the crops became the bad guys. Over time, we got used to thinking of bugs as dirty, diseased, and even poisonous, accusations that are mostly unfair. First, though you should never eat that roach from under your fridge, most bugs are no dirtier than anything else we eat. Have you ever seen a pig? Second, while it's true that some bugs like mosquitoes and flies can spread disease by biting, those bugs aren't the ones that people eat. People have learned not to eat the bugs that could make them sick. Puck says, "And never eat hermit crabs." Sisyphus says, "Or oysters. Yuck." The scorpion is thinking, "Dinner? Just who are they calling dinner?" A matter of taste. In North America and Europe, the idea of eating bugs is downright disgusting to most people. But even though we don't think of crickets and termites as food, lots of things we do eat are bug-related. Honey is made by bees. Shrimp, crayfish, crabs, and lobsters are all arthropods, which is what scientists call the bug group of animals. In fact, lobsters have only recently made the move from being thought of as bugs to being a gourmet treat. The first American colonists ate lobsters only when they didn't have anything else. In Massachusetts, servers who were tired of getting the cockroaches of the sea for dinner wrote into their contracts that they'd eat lobster only 3 times a week. Other parts of the world also have forbidden foods. Lots of people would never eat lobsters and the other sea-dwelling bugs we consider delicacies. Most people don't eat pork. Even among people who eat insects, tastes differ. South Africans might munch termites for lunch, but they'd never eat scorpions, which are raised for food in China. In Bali, Indonesia, dragonflies are a treat. But in the Indonesian province of Irian Jaya, no one would think of eating a dragonfly. Cicadas are on the menu instead. So when it comes to eating, people mostly stick with food they're used to. What's food and what's not is a matter of taste and what you've been taught. Future food. Could our tastes change? Will school lunches someday include grasshopper kebabs and caterpillar fritters? Attitudes about bugs are already changing. Thanks to bug tastings at schools and science centers, kids today are less squeamish about eating insects. For people who don't like all those legs, crickets can be ground up into a protein-rich flour. Bugs may even be a perfect food for long space journeys, since astronauts could raise them in space. Still wondering who on Earth would want to eat a bug? Better to ask who wouldn't. In the photograph, "They taste like popcorn," declares Elliot, who was brave enough to try dried larvae. In the other photograph, in the United States, the Hot Licks Candy Company sells bug-filled lollipops called Cricket Lickets. Man-eating bugs. If you're ever invited to David George Gordon's house for dinner, you may be served grasshopper kebabs or cockroach a la king. What else would you expect from the author of the Eat a Bug cookbook? What was the first bug you ever ate? A long time ago, I went to a bug fair in Seattle, and at it they were serving Chex Mix with crickets. I've eaten all sorts of unusual items, so it didn't seem that weird to me. What did the crickets taste like? Well, mostly I tasted the Chex Mix, but other crickets I've eaten since have a mild, shrimp-like flavor. Where do you buy the bugs you eat? You can buy crickets, mealworms, or waxworms at a pet store. They're good to experiment with because they've been raised to be eaten by lizards or other pets, and they're available year-round. What's your favorite bug to eat? The best-tasting ones, in my experience, are called waxworms. They're not worms at all, really. They're caterpillars. They eat the wax from honeycombs, and when you bake them, they taste like pistachio nuts. I use them in white chocolate and wax worm cookies. You do lots of bug cooking demonstrations at schools and museums. Once people try bugs, do they like them? I serve everyone small portions of crickets in pasta, and I've had people come back for fifth and sixth helpings. One kid said, "It's way better than anything my mom makes." What's the worst tasting bug you've ever eaten? None, really. The ones that don't taste good go out of their way to tell us so. They're brightly colored, and in the insect world, bright colors mean, hey, back off. Do you ever get grossed out eating bugs? The most difficult bug for me to eat was a tomato hornworm. It's a big green caterpillar that just doesn't look like food. My stomach was saying, red alert, red alert, and my brain was saying, go ahead, try it. What about a bug's hard exoskeleton? Isn't it hard to eat? It is a lot of work. You have to crunch through the bug's armor, and maybe after chewing and chewing and chewing, you can pass the armor into your napkin. So, did you eat the tomato hornworm? Sure. My advice for eating any new or weird food is to tell your stomach to cool it and just try stuff. Is there anything else we should know about eating bugs? If you're going to eat bugs, don't eat them raw. Cook them first. And don't collect bugs from your backyard or under the fridge. They've probably been eating pesticides, and you don't want to eat the pesticides that the bugs have eaten. Third, some people are actually allergic to bugs, especially people who are allergic to shellfish like shrimp or lobster. You need to be careful. Cricket cuisine. Does the idea of munching on bugs make you squirm? What about eating a cricket flour cracker instead? Cricket flour is made from crickets that are frozen, then dry roasted and ground up. But these bugs don't come from your backyard. They're raised under clean conditions on cricket farms. Crickets raised on farms need much less water, food, and energy than cows or other livestock, and they're even more nutritious. Not only are crickets a source of calcium, iron, and vitamins, but they have triple the amount of protein found in steak and double that of chicken. Cricket flour is ground up so well that there are no buggy bits to get caught in your teeth, and it has a slightly nutty taste. It can be used on its own or mixed into other flours to make crackers, energy bars, pasta, burgers, and more. But it might not be for everyone. People who are allergic to shellfish may also be allergic to crickets. Ask Jimmy and the Bug. Hey, Bug. Julian K. in D.C. asks, why do people faint? Do animals faint? You've been standing for hours at choir practice. The room is hot and stuffy. Suddenly you feel lightheaded. Your hands get cold. Then everything goes black. You hit the floor with a thud. A few minutes later you wake up. Everyone is staring at you. What happened? You fainted. Fainting happens when your blood pressure drops for a moment and your brain doesn't get quite enough blood. This causes you to lose consciousness or pass out. But as soon as you're lying down, more blood rushes to your brain and you wake up again. You're okay. Panic, heat, standing still for a long time, and skipping meals can all cause fainting. Fainting can be scary, but it's not usually dangerous unless you hit your head. If you start to feel faint, it sometimes helps to lie down or put your head between your legs. Though animals can faint, it's not very common. Even the famous fainting goats don't actually faint. They have a genetic defect that causes them to stiffen and fall over, but they're awake the whole time. Ask us anything. Ask at cricketmedia.com. This completes the September issue of Ask, Science and Exploration for Curious Kids. I'm Chris Radio volunteer Ron Pariser.